Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Okay, this month on Fire Marshal's Corner, we have two great shows. First, we're going to start with Tanya Hoover, who is the Acting State Fire Marshal from California. They recently just completed a study through a task group out there looking at the smoke alarm requirements for California and kind of specifically looking at the whole issue of photoelectric versus ionization, which is certainly a hot-button issue across the country right now. So this task group took a close look at it and generated a report, and we're going to be having a good conversation with Tanya Hoover talking about that. Following that, we're then talking with Gail Minger, who's the president of the Michael H. Minger Foundation, about the project where they just recently released a series of videos focusing on fire safety for students with disabilities, as well as an online guide to teaching fire safety to students with disabilities. So a lot of great resources there available on the Minger website to help you out. So stay tuned and listen to us here on Fire Marshal's Corner. Well, thanks for joining us on this month's issue of Fire Marshal's Corner. Joining us is Tanya Hoover, who's the Acting State Fire Marshal for California. Appreciate you joining us, Tanya.
Thank you, Ed, very much for the opportunity.
Yeah. I asked her to join us because they just released a smoke alarm task force report out of California that a number of people have been really waiting on because of this quite admittedly controversial issue of photoelectric versus ionization. And this came out in August. And I thought that Tanya could just give us an overview of the report, the findings, and the recommendations and such. So I guess really pretty basic question to start with is why did you even pull this task force together in the first place?
Well, thank you again, Ed, for the opportunity to talk about the work that the task force did and the report that was released in August. A lot of really important conversation, review of current testing work and other reports were reviewed, discussed, deliberated over a course of about 4 months with multiple meetings with the task force group. But we brought this task force group together because of the I don't even like to call it controversy, but because of the discussion surrounding appropriate technologies for smoke alarms and what technology belonged where. And we felt that in California, because many local jurisdictions were also taking a look at types of technology and where those technologies should be used at, that we felt that the State Fire Marshal's Office had the ability to pull together multitudes of folks from all over California, not only in the fire service and then the building official industry, but also those manufacturers listing and testing locations and businesses to really help review documents and get some what I'll call current information out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was your objective by bringing these experts together? And it is quite an impressive panel of people that you did pull together when I look at the report here. What were you hoping to come out on the other end when this is all said and done?
Well, the scope of this particular task force group was to address the effectiveness of smoke detector technology. And they were including but not limiting ionization and photoelectric, focusing on complying with the current California State Fire Marshal listing standards and those technologies used in residential occupancies as regulated by California. So we were very focused on California. The intent of this task force group and the report that followed in no way was to dictate to the rest of the country how to do business. Being the acting California State Fire Marshal, my focus was in California, protecting our citizens within the state of California.
Well, I mean, obviously, too, you know, you knew that it was going to have some national implications as well, because you may not call it a controversy, but there certainly is a lot of discussion going on this whole photoelectric ionization issue that really does need resolution, because there are some local jurisdictions in California that are adopting some rather strict or different regulations, aren't they, when it comes to the smoke alarms?
There are jurisdictions in California that have adopted, I'll call them specific criteria mm-hmm. for smoke alarm placements. I don't want to say they're more restrictive. They're just different. What we were trying to do at the task force level is to evaluate all the reports and discuss the appropriateness of the technology and where that technology is placed and how to get the message for placement out to the fire service, out to the building industry, out to the citizens.
Hmm. Well, maybe we can get kind of dive right into it. What were the findings of the task force?
Well, the task force had 16 findings, what they called their observations and conclusions. And anyone can go to the OSFM, the California State Fire Marshal's website, and pull the task force report right off of the front page. But I ask that when people do that, that they read the report in its entirety and don't just flip back to the 16 recommendations, because each one of the recommendations have value, and I don't think any one of them stands alone.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the areas that came out of the observations and conclusions is topics such as nuisance alarms, why we have what we call nuisance alarms, the placement of a device in relationship to our leading nuisance alarms being cooking. We also talked about silence features being an option, some changes or some proposals that can be made to the national code. Let's see here. We also talked about messaging. You know, how do we provide better messaging on the smoke alarm box that the citizen buys? You know, so that we can determine the appropriate placement for the technology. Trying to find some of the other items that.
What we can do is talk about a little bit about what does California require now when it comes to smoke alarms?
Now, California requires, in new construction,
mm-hmm.
California requires a smoke alarm be installed in every bedroom, in the hallway leading to a bedroom, on each level of a home.
Mm-hmm.
The provisions for older homes is that at least one smoke alarm be located in the home. When I say new technology, I believe the requirement for a smoke alarm in each bedroom became a code compliant in the mid-1990s.
Mm-hmm.
So structures built prior to that would be required to have at least one smoke alarm located. Now, the recommendations broke up into regulation and legislation and then messaging and education. A couple of the recommendations that came out was to look at potential legislation to introduce the requirement for smoke alarms in existing residential occupancies, very much like what California currently has for CO alarms, for CO detectors, which some people look at that as a retroactive provision. So there was a recommendation to look at legislation, and that would not be something that the state fire marshal's office would necessarily do, run legislation out of here. But I do know that there are a number of folks and organizations that would be very interested in proposing legislation for smoke alarms.
So what were they recommending then for?
Well, the recommendation was to require smoke alarms in existing residential occupancies that are being sold, leased, or rented to new tenants and owners, that they be provided a smoke alarm in accordance with the current smoke alarm requirements in the code.
Okay.
So, i.e., one in every bedroom, one in the hallway leading to bedrooms, and one on each level.
And you also require that those be interconnected?
Yes, they are interconnected and battery backup.
Okay. Now, how about types of sensing technology? Did they delve into what they would recommend for what type of sensor would be required?
They did talk about sensing, ionization versus photoelectric. There was no requirement to use one over the other, that each one of those technologies had its appropriate place. They did find that in relationship to cooking, you know, where you placed, for example, a conventional ionization technology would not be recommended to be used within 20 foot of fixed cooking appliances. Mm-hmm. And that was intended to address those nuisance alarms that happen with ionization and cooking. Mm-hmm. And that, when I talked about how each one of these recommendations tie into each other, that particular recommendation ties into an education and messaging recommendation, making sure that folks understand not to locate smoke alarms near cooking appliances and bathrooms. Things like replacing smoke alarms that are more than 10 years old, understanding and using the silencing features, better understanding the dangers that fire in modern residents pose to the residents and children. The idea is to use the technology appropriately.
Okay, now let's talk a little bit about that education and messaging. I see that when I was reading through the report, you were talking about improved messaging on the boxes and at the point of sale. Obviously, probably when most consumers go into a big box store or wherever, they just see this shelf full of different smoke alarms that, as fire safety professionals, we understand the difference.
Right.
But they look at it and it's just, you know, they probably zero in on what's the cheapest one there. You know, what sort of recommendations are you making to help the consumer make an intelligent choice in terms of what they should be putting in their home?
Well, some of the suggestions that would go back to the manufacturers were things like information about the technology on the front of the box, with maybe something of a photograph or a simple layout of a structure of a floor that shows, you know, this technology goes here, this technology shouldn't be placed here. Also reaching out through our messaging centers, both with the industry and fire service and building officials on how to present smoke detector placement or smoke alarm placement to our communities, whether that be handouts or through educational materials and different mechanisms of distributing that message. But the idea is to put that information on the box and understanding that's a small box. I'm all about green and reducing waste, so there is limited space on that box to get all this information, but I believe that when the great minds come together, they find a way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll have to admit, you know, and probably for full disclosure here, I'm on the 217 committee at UL that oversees this sort of stuff, and I had put forward a recommendation to try to come up with clearer graphics on there, just that sort of thing, an iconic system for, you know, to easily identify what's photoelectric, what's ionization, what's dual sensor, because I think that's the problem that a lot of people face. It's just, you know, not knowing what type, but also when you look at it, you know, you really have to read the fine print on the back of that box to see if it is indeed photoelectric or an ionization smoke alarm, which is, I think, a big problem.
Right. One of the other recommendations, like I said, there were 16, but one of them was having the state fire marshal send a letter to UL, to NFPA, and push to continue the research, continue adjusting based on technology, you know, how we test and list the appliance. And I'm proud to say that those letters are going through their final review right now to be released to UL, to the 217 folks, and to NFPA, to the Research Foundation, as well as each one of the manufacturers, to make them aware of the report and what our position is on the 16 recommendations.
Now, one of the things you also covered in the report is egress times, which have really changed dramatically over the years, haven't they?
Yes, they have. And that goes back to what we put in our homes. The structures have changed over the years. What we use in our homes are not the same thing that we placed and used in our homes, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. So those times have changed. Testing, as you know, continued to be done. In fact, a report in 2007, the latest edition, for testing criteria for alarm times for flaming fires, and then the alarm times ranged for the smoldering test. So when I asked this group to look at reports, I asked them to look at current information, 5 years, to find things that were no older than 5 years old. I was really not interested in anything that was 10 years old because I knew technology changed. I know that the dynamics of fire have changed. Granted, it's still hot and you still put it out with water, but what burns in our homes are different. So I wanted to be as current as possible on this topic. So we looked at reports that were done in 2007, and we looked at all of the reports inclusively. I think it's dangerous to pull one specific piece of a report out and use just that one piece of the report. I think you have to use testing holistically. So when they were looking at things like comparing response times, they didn't just look at one piece of the information in a report. They looked at the report in its entirety.
What's been the reaction to the report?
All over the place. You know, for the most part, it's been positive. And I think that speaks to that the fire service, those individuals that are interested in life safety are not closing their eyes to an issue. Contrary to what some people may believe, that folks are sweeping something under a carpet, that's not the case at all. We understand that this has a tremendous impact. There's an education message here. We want to make sure that it's clear, concise, and on target. We don't want partial information out there. And so folks have taken the report, I think, relatively in a positive way. I know that it's being used in a number of other states as a kickoff to some work that's being done. I believe Ohio is doing something right now, and they were interested in our report. Will this stop discussion? I hope not, and I think it has not. I think it's only helped discussion. I don't think any of us can be complacent to technology.
Now, you'd mentioned that you've got some letters in the pipeline that will be coming out soon. What other things are you looking to be doing in the near future and the far future for long-term as a result of this report?
Well, like I said, we've got letters that are going out. We're adapting those places where we can do some cleanup in our own regulations that maybe – let me back up here a second. What happens is – NFPA has a standard. California then adopts the, may not always be right on target with the most current NFPA standard. So what we have to do is take a current standard and modify the California code to meet that current standard. So we will be doing what we can with the 2010 NFPA 72 requirements, rolling those into our California regulations as we're going through our code adoption, and any other changes that we see that NFPA 72 may be doing, we'll roll those in as we go through our next our code cycle here. Staying in contact with UL and making sure that the items that came out of this report are part of discussions with the UL 217 committee and other members of Underwriters Laboratory. Pushing the education piece. In fact, come January, the State Fire Marshal's Office will stand up a group of individuals, what we call PEAC, which is the Public Education Advisory Committee. And an advisory committee for the State Fire Marshal is an appointed group of individuals that focus on a topic. In this case, it would be public education and outreach. And the smoke alarm messaging is one of those places that this group will target. And the idea is to get the message out there in a clear, concise, consistent method. So people will be hearing more about the PEAC committee. And then the NFPA Research Foundation, I'll be sending a letter to them as well, asking them to once again make smoke alarm technology, smoke alarm placement key to their research and to continue and look at the next phase of research for smoke alarms.
You'd mentioned it's available on your website. Do you want to tell us what the URL is for that?
I knew you were going to ask that question. Actually, that is http://osfm.fire.ca.gov.
And we'll also have a link on the page here that people can go straight from Firehouse to your site as well. But figure I just give you a chance to throw it out there because for people that are listening. Yep. Well, kind of while I have you too, if you don't mind, what else is kind of breaking in California? What other things are you folks working on right now?
Well, right now we're kicking off our next code cycle here in California for 2012. We'll be bringing quite a few groups of folks together to take a look at the California regulations and making the appropriate modifications to keep up with new technologies. Mm-hmm. We did what we call our best practices for water discharge, which many folks that are out there doing testing of fire pumps and sprinkler systems or even doing hydrant flows will be interested in, and those are the best management practices for water release, for water discharge, and how to meet the requirements or the intent of the Clean Water Act. And that report is also on our website. We've done work with looking at high-rise construction, those requirements within high-rises, how that affects our operational brothers and sisters so that they can do their job better. Is there something that we need to do differently in our code to help them? And or is there something that we need to take out that isn't helping them? So what I tell folks is I look at the new fire triangle, and it's training, operations, and prevention working together side by side with our communities well protected in the middle. So there's a number of items on our website. And, of course, our residential sprinkler provisions and the work that was done for residential sprinklers here in California also on the website.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly like that analogy on the new fire new fire safety triangle. That's a good one. I like that a lot. So
thank you. I also encourage folks to take a look at our green, what I call the Red and Green Initiative in California, and that is, of course, green building and red being red fire engines and trucks. And the work that we did with photovoltaic solar panels and emergency operations for safe operations on roofs that have PV panels. So there's a lot of really interesting and good work on our site under the State Fire Training tab as well.
And I think that's a topic we need to revisit. We did that about a year ago, looking at fireground operations with photovoltaic, and I think it's very timely. And with the growth of that whole industry, I think that's something that's probably even more timely to take a look at that again.
Absolutely. Alternate energies, I think the California Fire Service needs to understand it. Fire Service in whole needs to understand it. They're going to go out there, respond to an electric vehicle fire or an alternate energy hydrogen gas vehicle or something else, and they need to know what to expect to keep them safe.
Have you seen any incidents where they've gone bad because of that?
I have not seen any incidents myself. We've had a number of, I don't want to say number as in large amounts, but we've had reports come to us, and we've seen incidents having to do with PV panel fires on roofs, mm-hmm. and fire department having to respond to structure fires where they've gotten to the roof and found PV panel,
right.
Whether they be integrated into the roof or rooftop. So they're going to see more and more of it, and I think, you know, just like so much of what we do, we adapt and overcome. We want to make sure that we can adapt safely and overcome.
Well, certainly sounds like there's a lot going on in California. No surprise. But really do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about the Smoke Alarm Task Force report that did just come out, discussing the photoelectric ionization issues, among many others within the report. And I do encourage people to read it. It is a very good read, and it's available on the California State Fire Marshal's website. As I mentioned, on the Fire Marshal's Corner page here, we'll have a link to it as well. And for those of you that may be downloading this podcast through other sources, that URL again, Tanya, is
osfm.fire.ca.gov.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for taking the time to join us. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Okay. Look forward to having you back again sometime soon.
Thank you.
My name is Ed Kamel, and you're listening to Fire Marshal's Corner.
radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Well, joining us now in Fire Marshal's Corner is Gail Minger, who's the president of the Michael H. Minger Foundation. I'm glad you could join us, Gail.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Gail's going to be talking about a great project that she has really just put together and launched in the past few months here, which is on fire safety for students with disabilities. And right up front, I guess, for full disclosure, I have to say that I also worked on this project with Gail. So you may hear some odd conversation going on here as I ask her questions that she's going to probably say, Ed, you know the answer to that one. But the people out there don't. So we just want to let them know everything that you're doing here, Gail, that it's just a tremendous work that you've been putting together here. So really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. I appreciate you asking me. I think it's a very important topic.
Yep. Well, I think probably the first thing is maybe explain a little bit about the Michael Minger Foundation, how it came to be, and why you're focusing on fire safety for students with disabilities. So maybe you could just give us a little walkthrough on that, Gail?
Sure. Well, in 1998, my son Michael was attending a college, and he died in a fire in his dorm. And Michael had a learning disability that affected his spatial and directional abilities, some processing abilities as well. And although he had these issues, Michael had a 3.936 GPA and was a very good student in college. But this particular disability that he had impacted him the night of the fire and was a contributing factor to his death. So since his death, I've really been wanting to look more into issues with what we have since called a silent disability, because these students look very normal. You know, they're not in a wheelchair or like you might see other students and immediately know what their disability would be. With a student with learning or disorders, it's not obvious. So that's why we call it the hidden disability. And that's why I'm really focusing a lot on that with college students.
Now, Gail's gotten two grants. In a previous grant, one of the things we did was a study looking at what campuses are doing when it comes to fire safety education for students with disabilities. And what was the findings on that study, Gail?
Well, there were huge gaps. It was all over the place. You had some schools that were aware and had a few things in place. But what we found were the department, say housing, thought the security and safety folks were doing it. The safety folks thought the fire folks were doing it. So actually, no one was doing it really well. I mean, as I said, some schools absolutely had it on their radar screen and were attempting, but there were just huge gaps, and we found that it was certainly an area that needed attention, and so that's why we took the project on.
Mm-hmm. So got a second grant, and it was actually two projects, too. We'll touch on one of them in a little bit, but I just do want to focus on the disability one here if we can. Mm-hmm. There's this gap. Schools aren't delivering fire safety information, and I think one of the reasons that we came across was just there's kind of a lack of tools. Schools are saying, well, yeah, it's something we need to do, but okay, what do we use? How do we do that?
Right, and some schools also said, well, we think fire safety is for, you know, any student. It should be for the same for students with disabilities, and we found that that just is not the case because there are certain apparatus and so forth that's needed. It wasn't, it's not supplied on every campus. We found that to be, you know, pretty amazing. And so things like that, it really isn't the same. In fact, my belief is that when you raise the standard or prepare for students with disabilities, you really, and those that are a little more vulnerable in our society, you really are raising the standard and fire safety for all. So that's kind of how I come from that.
And I can't agree with you more, because it's, you know, it's that whole concept of universal access or universal design. I mean, originally they put in handicap ramps to help people with mobility impairments, and in reality, well, who winds up using it? It's the woman with a stroller, or it's the person doing a delivery, or something like that. It's used by everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that's for everybody. So what are some of the tools that you did put together? What are some of the tools that came out of this grant?
Well, we were very fortunate to find some wonderful young people that are college students, and we had them go through some areas of that we identified that schools were very interested in, or areas of need. For example, egress, cooking, and fire safety equipment. So we talked with each of these students, and we actually videoed them sharing information about things they should and should not do in dealing with these three areas of interest. So, and we had a student, a blind student, a student, deaf student, mobility impaired student, and a learning young man with Asperger's that fell on the learning disorder area. So it was just really eye-opening for them to be joined with this project and basically also tell us the things that they needed. And I think we learned a lot as well. So the students, in presenting their videos, they'll be talking to their peers. They're all closed caption accessible. So we thought that was a great beginning tool, and then we added a train-the-trainer segment where the students actually were talking to, like, your fire folks, your first responders, on how to approach them, things that they needed. And I thought that was very powerful. That was our second addition to our videos.
And each of these videos is it's pretty short. I mean, you know, we're focusing kind of on the YouTube generation, so
yes.
You know, you have to kind of tell a story within 4 or 5 minutes, which is hard to do. But I think it was done pretty successfully.
I agree. I think it was. We there are a lot of other areas of interest, you know, smoking, candles, other things that we could not or have not yet touched on, but that's what we hope to include in the future. But I think the most important thing, I believe, was the egress segment along, well, all of it was important, but, and I think the students as well learned a lot in participating in this project. And we've gotten a lot of interest in it across the nation, so I'm very appreciative that we have the opportunity to do this important work.
And these videos, too, were, like I had mentioned, just shot in the YouTube style.
Yes.
And to make that happen, you had a pretty good producer here who put it together, didn't you?
We sure did. When working with college students, my number one preference is to utilize college students. And we had a young man that from the Boston area that was just getting his master's degree, and he did the work, and he did an outstanding job. And so I was very, very pleased. And I always enjoy using students to do the work that we're looking to do. So
it's kind of a suite of videos that are about campus fire safety for students with disabilities, starring students with disabilities, produced by a student itself. I mean, you couldn't ask
exactly.
for a more winning combination than that, could you?
Exactly. And I think the students themselves know what they need more than what, you know, us older generation folks think we know what they need. And that's what I really appreciated, was their energy and willingness to share that. And the people that have seen them so far, it really impacted them, because they said, you know, these are the people that have these issues, and they're the ones speaking about them. So that to me was very powerful, and to everyone that's seen them. So.
And the train-the-trainer video is a little bit different in that that's the focus audience on that are the people doing the fire safety education. And I would have to say the biggest thing I came away with on doing this grant was that this project is that so often first responders and others and myself included, you know, you kind of assume what these people need. You assume what somebody who's in a wheelchair needs to be helped, or what somebody who's deaf or blind. And quite often that is not what we think they need is not what they need. And I really remember one of the biggest things, one of the students is just kept saying to me, ask me what I need, you know, and I think that's the biggest thing that probably a lot of people don't do is just simply ask them what they need for their own safety.
Exactly. And like our young lady, Sherry, that was mobility impaired, she was saying, just because my legs don't work, my arms, my hands, you know, my mind works. And I thought that was pretty significant, as well as our young lady, Sarah, who had a hearing impairment, saying, don't yell at me. You know, you can talk to me in conversational tones. But that's exactly, she kept repeating, you know, just ask me and I can help you if you just ask me. Don't assume. So I thought that was a very, very good point that the students made, and very good for the first responders and folks to understand, because they're wondering too. You know, Ed, I think that they have a question: what do I do with or for this student? And here the students are telling them. So I thought it was very, very good.
I mean, I remember the funniest thing was we're filming Sherry, the student in the wheelchair, and so we had to film her going down the hallway to her second egress, second means of egress. And she is just whipping down this hallway, and we're running to keep up with her with the camera crew and everything. It was just, so she was down there well before we were. We had to actually have her slow down a little bit so we could keep up to film her.
Remember her also saying that, you know, she was used to people just carrying her out, friends and so forth. But, you know, I think she learned that friends aren't always available, and, you know, she needed to have a plan. So that was kind of an eye-opening to me, to think that, you know, she just, well, my friends will carry me. And so just kind of matter of fact. And just I think a lot of important points were made and by the students, and things that will certainly get people's attention. And I hope to, you know, enlighten them on exactly where we need to go from here in helping students with disabilities minimize their risk and possibly save their lives.
Well, accompanying this, put together a guide, a printed online guide for teaching fire safety for students with disabilities. And again, the audience for this guide is the fire safety educator. And so can you give us a little bit of overview of what's in the guide?
Well, the guide has several different elements. One that I really like that's in the guide that we got help from lots of experts around the country is etiquette about how to deal with the students, things to do and not do, which I thought was really very helpful. And then in each of the areas, Ed, you worked so hard on this guide. Maybe if you would be so kind to, you know, fill in some of the other points, highlight the other points of it, because it's also gotten a great response to the guide as well.
Sure. I mean, one of the things, we put a lot into this guide, and as Gail mentioned, we built on the research that a lot of other people have been doing, U.S. Fire Administration, NFPA, but I have to give a really special shout-out to Oklahoma State University and Nancy Trench. What Gail mentioned, that social etiquette section, we really just took a lot of the material that they used and put it together in this guide, so it's kind of a one-stop shop for a lot of this information. And that section, what I thought was so important, because totally unintentionally, a lot of people may be doing social faux pas when dealing with somebody who has a disability. Like you just mentioned, you know, when you're talking to somebody who's deaf, you know, you don't need to shout at them, but you do need to look right at them, so they may possibly be able to read your lips. Or you may need a sign language interpreter when you're doing the programs. Things like that we covered in the guide to really give guidance to the fire safety educator, and also some of these special concerns that you may have to take into account for somebody. I mean, probably the biggest thing, and we did this with Sherry, the woman in the wheelchair, was we talked about a second means of egress, and she had said, well, I'll just use the elevator. And I said, well, what if the elevator goes to ground when the fire alarm system activates, which many elevators do? And she had never known about that. She had never thought about that. So we actually went the route of the second means of egress and identified potential problems along that way. And as Gail had mentioned earlier, egress is just such an important thing that if there's one takeaway, if there's one thing they leave with, is knowing two ways out, you know, no matter where they are or when they are. And so that's the other point we made in the guide, is actually practicing with these students even more so that, you know, they can identify potential problems along the way that need to be corrected. You know, are there recycling barrels in the way, for example? Is there even not a usable means of egress for somebody in a wheelchair? For somebody who is blind, who really relies on sound to help them orient themselves in their space, and they do it more than sighted people do because it's just one of the senses available to them. Fire alarm system's going off, that's going to be a pretty overwhelming sound, and they're going to become really disoriented possibly. Right. So there are things like that we included in this guide. And the idea behind the guide is we're not teaching fire safety. We're assuming the person reading this already knows fire safety education. They already know about cooking and candles and smoking and egress and all those sort of things. But what they may need a little bit of help in is how to translate that message into a way that is most effective for students with disabilities. And I think one of the areas that you really mentioned, Gail, is that of the hidden disability. Is a student with a learning disability that are becoming more and more common in today's colleges. And I don't know, can you possibly go over some of the things that first responders have to be aware of when educating these students? Because, you know, that's you live that with Michael, so I think you're probably the best person to really talk about that.
Well, absolutely. They, the students, and there's such a wide gamut of learning differences, learning disorders. And so we did focus on Asperger's because, as Ed mentioned, the many, many students today are going to college because they're able to. As I said, Michael had a 3.936 GPA, which is a higher GPA than his twin sister, who's now a doctor. So it's just a matter that these kids are very capable, but they have differences in their learning styles, and a lot of them have their social issues, which that's when it comes into play, when they're back in their residences and these kinds of things where you may have problems with casualty or catastrophic situations may come up, that they will have a problem. So it seems like so much is done in the classroom, but then it's like they just leave their disability in the classroom. Well, they don't. It goes with them to their residence, their dorms, wherever they live. And some of the things, for example, our Asperger student, he shared with us that touch is very difficult for him, other than just a handshake. Touching him was very hard. He didn't like it. He responds very negatively. So you don't grab a person with Asperger's. Being very literal, like my Michael was, you have language specific, telling them to stay here in a certain place and giving a time frame. You have to be they're very language specific, so you have to kind of be careful about that. Another thing are sounds. When these alarms and things go off, it really sends them. It scares them. Some of them could retreat into their closets, just like a very small child, but that's how these students react. They can be the entrepreneurs of the future, but they have these issues that are very real, and it's just how their neurons, and it's just how things work for them, and it can be very scary for them in a situation. Sometimes I think, like a student with a mobility impairment, they know what their needs are and how you can help them. The students with the hidden disabilities, they're a little more challenging because you can't see what they need. And I think that this is an area we want to look into more because there is such a wide variation. But every single aspect of it is important. But we did focus on our students with Asperger's. So.
And you brought up a really good point on the sound, I think, and that showed in one of the videos where Ian was not comfortable testing the smoke alarm himself, so he had to have somebody else do it with him. And you could see and react to it and such. And so there are things like that that the first responder might need to know, or the fire safety educator might need to know, that these are just things that we need to do to accommodate these students and make it work for them. So.
Right. And they're really not – they're simple things most of the time, that, and just knowing, just having that guide and knowing some of these things can really, keeping the students calm. That was one thing Ian, our Asperger student, also mentioned, is if you help me remain calm, because they get very, they often think that everything is a catastrophe. You know, they really blow it out of proportion, not meaning to. Again, it's just how their brain works. And so, therefore, helping them remain calm is really an important part of dealing with them in a fire or crisis situation. So that was something else that was a good point made.
Right. Well, you know, unfortunately, we have run out of time, and I did want to talk to you about the other project, but I think what I'd like to do is ask you to come back next month, Gail, and maybe we can cover the other project that the foundation's been doing.
Sure.
If that's okay with you.
Thank you. Well, I think this is such an important, a very important area of fire safety, and I think there's much more work to do, and I'm really looking forward to adding even more to the work we've done.
Well, all the videos and the guide that we've been talking about are available absolutely free of charge from the Minger Foundation's website, which is www.mingerfoundation.org. There'll be a link on the Firehouse page here that'll take you to that. And all the videos are closed captioned and totally accessible for people with disabilities and available for streaming through the website. So thank you very much for joining us today, Gail. We really look forward
thank
to talking
you.
To you next month.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. This has been Fire Marshal's Corner with Ed Kamau. Well, another great show here on Fire Marshal's Corner, talking with Tonya Hoover, Acting State Fire Marshal for California, about the results of the Smoke Alarm Task Group, and Gail Minger, President of the Michael H. Minger Foundation, talking about fire safety for students with disabilities. And if you didn't catch the links in there, we'll have them here on the page below on firehouse.com, where you can access both of those organizations and get the information that they were both talking about. So thanks for joining us this month on Fire Marshal's Corner. My name is Ed Kamau.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.